Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 178 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and let me introduce the co-hosts. First up, we have Dan Webb from the Things in the Sky blog. Hey, Dan.
I wasn't expecting to be first. Hi.
The rotation is always a mystery, huh? Also with us is David Vanderhoof from the What Just Flew By blog. Hi, David.
The rotation isn't a mystery. I just can never remember who was first last week.
Actually, truth be told, I'm not sure I remembered to rotate it, so this might be the same as last week. And then we also have with us Rob Mark from the Jetwine blog. Hi, Rob.
Hey, good evening from beautiful Chicago, where we actually had a dusting of snow just in time for Christmas.
Did you really? Keep it there.
Well, it's already kind of melted, but that's okay.
All right. Our guest this episode is Bill English. Bill's a commercial pilot, multi and instrument CFI. He's flown corporate, charter, some other things, and he was an air traffic controller in Boston and New York. Bill's even written for IFR magazine in the past, and he's worked on procedures design and internal investigations for the FAA. Currently, however, Bill is with the NTSB, the National Transportation Safety Board. He's an investigator in charge in the Major Aviation Investigations Division. Bill, welcome to the podcast.
Good evening, guys. Happy to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you. We've been talking about the NTSB and just investigations in general throughout the year, so it's fantastic to have someone who can speak with some authority and explain to us how the process works, so we're looking forward to that. Maybe you could just let us know, just to get an idea, how many active investigations do you have right now?
Well, in my case, probably looking at about a dozen.
Really?
And as a major investigator, I'll cover the domestic air carrier 121 events, which thankfully we don't have a whole lot, but also through the ICAO Annex 13 procedures, we do a lot of work overseas. So I've got a number of non-U.S. investigations going as well, where we've got a U.S. manufactured aircraft or a U.S. operator or registered aircraft.
Well, good. We're really looking forward to having a conversation with you about those. So we'll look for that coming up. First, however, we're going to go over a bit of the aviation news from the past week. After that, we'll talk with Bill about the NTSB and his activities. As always, David is going to come in with his This Week in Aviation History segment. And then we have the Australia Desk, Peter Johnson's Across the Pond segment covering European aviation. And we have, after that, we have so much more. We have a lot of Grill the Geeks questions. We have Grill the Listeners questions and quite a bit of listener email. So we're going to try to get through as much of that as we can. That's going to be a real challenge, though. But first up, let's talk news. Our first article comes from GeekWire. This is with a Strato launch project. Paul Allen makes a big bet on commercial space flight. Now, in case you don't know, Paul Allen was a Microsoft co-founder along with Bill Gates. So he has the privilege of being able to invest actual money in things that the rest of us can only dream about. He's the sole financier of this Strato launch project. And this is intended to be an aircraft platform for launching spacecraft from the air. Now, you might think it's kind of a crazy idea until you look at the airplane. And it, to me anyway, it immediately puts the name of Burt Rutan in your head because it shares some similarity of design with Spaceship One.
Oh, yeah. I looked at the video, too. I mean, that's exactly what I took away, is that it's kind of a larger version of Spaceship One put to a more commercial use. And I thought his comment was kind of good, that you can't get a feel for the size of the vehicle in the video. Yeah, but when it says it has 6 747 engines, which would be, what numbers would those be, Dan or Max?
Those would be sort of in the sort of 60,000 pound thrust class. Times six. So this thing is pretty big. It's got a 385-foot wingspan and of course, a twin fuselage, one of which is a 747. From the video, it kind of looks like it's maybe a 747 SP sized airplane. I don't know, Dan, did you kind of get to that conclusion?
How many are left? Like, even they're even flyable, though.
I don't know how much modification they plan on doing. It looks like one of the two fuselages is the 747, and the other one looks kind of that size, but I'm not sure it's an actual 747 grafted on, because from the video, from the animation, it looks like it's a little bit different. But this thing is huge. They say the gross weight is over 1.2 million pounds, and they figure that they can put a payload as much as 13,500 pounds into low Earth orbit.
Am I the only one who read this article and wondered, okay, who's got a runway wide enough for this thing to take off?
Well, that's
thank you. That was going to be my next point, David. Good man. I mean,
well,
that's
a civil engineer in the genetics coming through. I know how much concrete a C-130 or a C-5 takes, or 747. So
yeah,
double a 747, and I don't know. I guess it'll be I don't know. They're going to have to take off on some dry lake bed somewhere,
or they'll have to have a specially constructed runway out there someplace.
No, they might. Yeah. The parties involved in this, I mean, these are not lightweights. I mean, besides Burt Rutan in you know, scaled composites, you've got SpaceX doing the multi-stage booster and Dynetics doing the integration and some other things. So of all the folks they could assemble to actually pull this off, I think they've got the right players.
They've got all the right players, but in order for this to be an economically feasible thing, you want to take off on from various airports depending upon where you're going to put the satellite in orbit. If you launch from the same airfield all the time, you're not going to get the benefit. You're going to be able to put a satellite in X orbit. You're going to have to be able to move and take off from various fields around the world depending upon what kind of trajectory you want your satellite to go to.
Yeah, I guess. And they mentioned the range. I don't recall the number, but they mentioned the range that that this aircraft will have. And it's pretty significant. So at least to a certain degree, I guess you'll be able to fly to that, you know, ideal launch location. The website is stratolaunch.com, so you can take a look at that. And I'm sure that these guys will make the news pretty regularly as they, you know, progress along with their little project.
It is interesting, though. It makes you wonder that when you see the demise of the shuttle and the rise of Spaceship One and the Strato, what do we call this thing? The Strato launch. Sorry, the Strato launch. It makes you wonder what would have happened if they'd announced the end of the shuttle a decade earlier, if we'd have been this far involved in private launch vehicles, and who knows.
Yeah, interesting question. So, but yeah, space flight, I mean, it really does seem to be going more towards the direction of private, commercial enterprises as opposed to just strictly a government activity.
So do you think the NTSB will be out there to investigate incidents and accidents in space if something like that happens, Bill? I mean, have you ever done a spacewalk? Or?
No, I haven't. I haven't got a pressure suit windbreaker yet. But
that's what I was thinking.
Yeah, we do have statutory authority for that. Commercial space launch or space vehicles do come under our coverage. If something like this were to have an accident, we'd be the lead agency to investigate it. We have a person who has that as a collateral duty, just like I have a collateral for unmanned aircraft investigations.
Oh, yeah, and we've got to talk about that.
Oh, boy.
Okay, let's move on to next story. This is from this is a Boeing press release. Boeing 737 MAX logs first firm order from launch customer Southwest Airlines. So the press release states Southwest Airlines announced a firm order for 150 737 MAX airplanes. Southwest is the first customer to finalize an order for the 737 MAX and becomes the launch customer for the new engine variant. So I guess this now becomes the new largest order ever for Boeing.
I think this is like the third this year.
Yes.
Earlier we had Emirates, which was largest by list price value. Then Lion Air, which I think was largest by value and by number of airplanes. And now this, I think.
The Southwest, of course, is they're solely Boeing.
Yeah, I mean, Southwest has Well, they haven't always had a common fleet. Back in the early days, if you go through some of the archives, you'll see some pictures of a Southwest 727. Also, I guess technically, back in the day, there were some Southwest-owned Douglas aircraft when they owned a Transtar.
Ah.
But yeah, Southwest is pretty synonymous with the 737, and you know, probably one of the first carriers that led the way among other low-cost carriers, and the rest of the industry, this focus on fleet commonality. So I guess the fact that Southwest is going with the 737 MAX really isn't shocking. I mean, they've been the launch customer of the 737-300, the 500, and the 700. So
yeah,
they've said some things about the MAX over the past few months. But there are a couple of interesting things here going on. Because some other changes took place in the order book. There were the 150 737 MAX aircraft, but also Southwest ordered an additional 58 current generation 737s. And Southwest continues to appear pretty interested in the 737-800. They had recently changed their 737 order book to have some 800s coming next year. And before, they just had 33 of those aircraft coming next year, 28 from Boeing and 5 from a leasing, well, 5 leased aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
But then with this latest delivery schedule update, Southwest was previously going to take 23 737-700s in 2013, and now with these latest order book changes, no 700s in 2013 and 41 737-800s.
Mm-hmm.
And Southwest did say they have the flexibility for the 737 MAX, the Dash 7 and the Dash 8 variant. So we'll see what happens there. But I think it makes sense. I mean, they're competitors. You know, American, Virgin America, JetBlue, and Frontier have all, and Spirit now have all made some kind of move here with some narrow body, new narrow body fleet orders. All those airlines have gone with the A320neo. American has the 737 MAX as well, and Republic, which owns Frontier, has a C-Series in order. So, you know, it's kind of a natural step as they do their fleet renewal. I think, actually, I was going through an old SEC filing from September, and the 737-300s and 500s are both about 20 years old. So they need to renew the fleet. And then plus, also, there is a note from Gary Kelly sent to all Southwest employees that was floating around recently, talking about how Southwest has been losing its cost advantage that it's had. I mean, they still have one, but it's smaller than what it was, partially because all these legacy carriers have been able to go through bankruptcy and restructure their costs, and now American's going through that process. So, you know, having Southwest reinvest in its fleet and go with this 737 MAX, which has improved fuel efficiency, and, you know, fuel is, depending on the exact price, is jockeying for most airlines to be, you know, either your number one or number two cost. So they need to help keep those costs down, so this will help in that area.
I bet Boeing and Southwest have been talking about this deal for a long, long time. I mean, I have no particular inside information, but it took a while for Boeing to announce the 737 MAX, and I just find myself wondering if it wasn't because they weren't going to do that until they had, you know, kind of a pretty good idea that Southwest was going to take this kind of action. Because, I mean, this really sort of cements, I mean, they have a lot of orders. Boeing says they have orders more than 900 for the 737 MAX, but I think that they really would want to have Southwest on board with this.
Well, yeah, for a couple of reasons. I mean, number one, Southwest has been an incredibly loyal Boeing customer. I mean, I just looked at the Boeing orders and deliveries page, and over the past, you know, over 40 years here, roughly, well, just about 40 years, Boeing has delivered over 580 737s to Southwest.
Yeah.
So,
wow.
Big customer. And you actually have to kind of wonder, I mean, for a while there, Boeing, at least publicly, seemed pretty committed to the whole concept of a clean sheet narrow body that would be available in, what, the 2020-ish time frame?
Yeah.
So you kind of have to wonder what Southwest and other major customers, what they thought of that.
And Southwest could have been a huge influence, I think. If Southwest didn't want to wait and Southwest wanted Boeing to do a re-engine, I think that they would have a lot of influence on Boeing's decision to do that or not.
Yeah, I think major customers like that, and also the fact that for the past, and well, over the past the months leading up to the 737 MAX announcement, I mean, Airbus has been had some very strong sales for the A320neo as well. So, I mean, it's just interesting to see how these two aircraft are working out, because I feel it almost in a way, locks in might be too strong a term, but I get, you know, a lot of the orders, in my opinion, with the exception of American, haven't really been that shocking in the sense that current 737 and current A320 operators have kind of just stuck with this airframe and are just going with the next generation of that.
Yeah. All right, let's talk a little bit about the TSA. The TSA has been in the news recently. We see from Mercury News, TSA chief in favor of advocates at all airports. Now, the TSA has advocates at some, I'm not sure how many, but some of the major airports. But the TSA administrator, John Pistol, has said that he's in favor of putting consumer advocates at all U.S. airports. Sounds like, I guess, a good idea.
He was kind of nudged into that, though. If I remember,
there was some pressure.
What I read, yeah, I mean, it was after Senator Schumer nudged him and said, "You know, why are you strip searching this old lady?" And
I get why people are angry. I really do, but it almost seems like it's the equivalent of like saying, like, "Well, we have a problem." And the answer to this problem is we're just going to make a committee whose job is to look at the problem. Like, it just seems like another just layer of bureaucracy. Like, how much is a consumer advocate, which I'm assuming is going to obviously be a civilian, I'm guessing, you know, how much are they really going to get done?
That's an interesting question. I mean, I think it mentioned that there were already some consumer advocates, didn't it?
Yes.
I guess I wonder if those are civilians or if those are TSA employees.
And how effective are they being? I mean, that would be the first obvious question.
Yeah, I mean, you almost, I don't know. I feel like issues like this could, you would hope that TSA leadership would, I don't know. I'm not optimistic.
If they're acting in the interests of the flying public and are truly advocates for those consumers, then it should have some value.
But what does that mean exactly?
Yeah, I mean, I don't
how
know.
Will they, see, and I don't think anybody else does either. In fact, it's funny, I came back from Dallas the other day and I was tweeting as I went through the line because I saw this sign at Love Field that said, "If you're a kid under 12, don't bother to take off your shoes. You don't have to. You get to go through with your shoes on." And I thought, so then if I was the bad guy, wouldn't I load up
12-year-old
stuff in the kid's shoes? I don't know. Why are they doing that when they're, you know, searching old ladies in wheelchairs? I don't know.
Bill, do you get to breeze right through security with your NTSB jacket, or are you treated the same as everyone else?
No, when I fly commercial, just a regular old civilian.
Okay.
So the one nice thing is, I think last week the TSA pre-check program expanded to include Vegas. So for American and Delta flyers, It's basically, I don't know I haven't been through it, and I can't provide experience, but basically certain travelers, and I think it's, you know, it's your mileage may vary, but it's certain frequent flyers are also, if you're in like some of the government programs, like Global Entry, and the name escapes me right now, but I think there's a government program for easy crossing into Canada. If you're in part of those, you can get access to this TSA pre-check program, which is basically a less intense screening. So hopefully that will expand further across the country and at least make life easier for some people.
Yeah, but you know what? I heard that the one in Vegas has another requirement that you have to be able to do something with a pole or something. I don't know.
Okay, Bill, you had something serious to say?
I knew that was coming.
No, that sounded a little bit like, remember the CLEAR program? I guess that never then it really worked out, huh?
CLEAR, no. We would need Aunt Benet to come up. But basically, CLEAR was supposed to be something like this, but eventually, due to, I don't know, government friction, it basically became a glorified concierge program.
Hmm. Yeah, but come on, seriously, why is this so hard? I mean, really. I just don't understand why somebody like, I don't know, any of us, that if you flew regularly, you couldn't fill out some kind of an application, go through a screening check, whatever it is, get through it once and somebody says, yeah, we've checked him. He's okay. He's cool. And you go through a different line. I mean, what is the big deal about this?
Well, I don't know. That's a good question. Maybe they lack confidence in getting through that one secure check and it being, you know, good, you know, forever or for some period of time. I don't know. Maybe they just think that.
For God's sake, I'll pay an extra $10 when I renew my passport.
Yeah.
For them to do a complete security check so that they can put a sticker on my passport that says I'm cleared.
It would make traveling a lot nicer.
David, I guess you can kind of, I don't know how much it costs by applying to the thing, something like Global Entry. But, you know, only certain airports at this point. So I don't think it's in, it wouldn't really help you at this point.
Yeah, Dan, I think Global Entry only works when you're coming back in through customs. I have that. It doesn't do anything for TSA.
Well, actually, for the TSA pre-check thing, some of the people who are allowed access are the people who do Global Entry.
Oh, I gotcha.
Right. Yeah.
Well, the only other problem these days at airports is apparently you have to watch out for stray bullets. And we see in a Reuters article, this is titled, Gun from Passenger's Bag in Atlanta Airport Accidentally Fired. I find this incredible. But somebody at the Hartsfield-Jackson Atlanta International Airport apparently had a loaded .22 caliber pistol in their baggage. Well, the security screeners found it, so that's good. And then a police officer was trying to unload it, and the gun fired, and a fragment grazed the officer. This is just the idea that somebody would carry a loaded gun in their baggage just is beyond me.
You know, Max, there's a number of thoughts that come from that. I saw that same story. There's not a lot of detail to it, but just so you know, in addition to flight instructor, I'm also a firearms instructor and competitor. I travel with firearms all the time. Uh-huh. There's a right way and there's a wrong way to travel with a firearm, and it's pretty easy to figure out the right way. The TSA and the airlines publish the procedures on their websites. It's not really all that difficult to do it the right way. Big hint, in your carry-on, it's not the right way.
Right.
So that's pretty plain right there, and there's also a right way and a wrong way to safe a firearm when you have to. And I mean, just again, based on that story, there's not a lot of detail, but keeping your finger off the trigger and not pointing the muzzle at a metal table probably ranks right up there.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
But you know what I thought was the even more amazing part of that story was that line at the end said that so far this year, the TSA has confiscated over 1,100 weapons. I mean,
firearms.
You know, hello. I mean, 10 years after 9/11, people still think, well, let's see, a knife, a gun. Yeah, I can do that. That's okay. Mm-hmm. I mean,
it's hard to fathom. I mean, a lot of times when that happens and when there's a particular, incident that's reported, the passenger said, oh, you know, they forgot that it was in the bag or something. But I can't believe 1,100 guns have been forgotten in bags.
This guy said he only had the gun with him to not to kill people, but just to scare them. I would have said that would have it worked on me.
Yeah.
So I'm more concerned about how many, in addition to the 1,100, were not caught.
How many got through?
Oh, yeah. Good point.
I think that might be the,
real question. Again, our guest this episode is Bill English from the NTSB. Bill, can you scope what the NTSB's investigations are? What does the NTSB investigate, and what does it not investigate?
Sure. The NTSB, as some people know, maybe not everybody knows, is an independent agency. We're non-regulatory. We're not part of the FAA. We're not part of the DOT. Completely independent. Made up of five politically appointed, Senate-confirmed board members. So that's the board with the capital B. And we have a staff of less than 400 people. And the staff is divided up into the different transportation modes. So that's aviation, where I am, of course. Mm-hmm. We also cover marine, which is largely the heavy commercial ships. So cruise ships, oil tankers, things like that.
Right.
Rail, highway. Again, that's usually heavy commercial vehicles. And then along with rail is also pipeline and hazardous materials. So that's all divided up amongst those 400 or so people. And then we also have a laboratory that supports all the modes, metallurgists there, fire scientists, and a recorder's lab. So in aviation, what we investigate is pretty much anything that isn't military,
okay,
or a really small ultralight or a model. Anything else comes under the NTSB's investigations when there's an accident.
And how does the NTSB get notified? I mean, do you observe them and then activate yourselves, or does someone pick up the phone and say, you know, hey, you guys are on? How does that notification process work?
Oh, good question. Good question. That's covered in our regulations. That's the 49 Code of Federal Regulations 830. And Rob, I'll bet way back in dim memory, you remember those questions on the written test back when you got your private pilot's license about Part 830.
Yes.
That defines what is an accident, what you have to report to the NTSB. So accidents we have to investigate by statute. That's our congressional mandate to investigate accidents, determine the probable cause. And then there's various things that an aircraft operator has to report to the NTSB, things like in-flight fires, things like that. And we might or might not investigate one of those. And we sometimes investigate things that aren't covered, like the Northwest Airlines lost comm event. You remember that a little while back.
Were they missed Minneapolis, you mean?
Exactly. That, if you look in Part 830, is not covered at all, yet we did launch an investigation. So how do we find out about these things? On paper, it says the operator has to call one of our regional offices as soon as possible and file a report and so on. And that probably works okay with small general aviation type of things. For an air carrier, for anything large, generally we really find out about it first through the media. We have a 24/7 communication center that's here at our headquarters in D.C. They monitor all the cable news outlets, internet media, and so on. And generally, that's one of the first sources that we hear about a major accident. And another source, of course, is from the FAA, a lot of times because air traffic control is the first witness to whatever that accident might be. So FAA will let us know right away. So there's a number of different ways that we'll get notified and then start to scope our response.
Now, sometimes the accidents are in the U.S. and sometimes you see the NTSB being involved in accidents that occur outside the U.S. So when does the NTSB's reach extend beyond the borders?
Right. That's covered, again, now under the ICAO, the International Civil Aeronautics Organization, that sets standards for all the nations that are signatories, which is just about everybody. Part of that treaty is called Annex 13, and that governs accident and incident investigation around the world. Basically, how that boils down is that the country in which the accident occurs is investigation. So obviously, in the U.S., we lead, and we'd be the agency that does that. And accident occurs, say, in Spain. The Spanish agency would lead that. But then the state, the country, state in diplomatic speak, of course,
right,
of the manufacturer of the aircraft or the engines or other major components has a role to play. They'll participate by treaty. And the country of registration or the operator will play a role. So naturally, we've got U.S. product all over the world. So wherever there's a Boeing, McDonnell Douglas, Gulfstream, Pratt & Whitney engines, sometimes Honeywell Avionics, by treaty we're part of that investigation, so we'll participate right alongside our foreign counterparts. And that's the same for the other. My counterparts from French BEA, Brazil CINIPA, the Canadian TSB do the same thing as well, following their manufactured products around the world.
Now, I've got one question that, I mean, I think I know the answer to this, but I think a lot of the public kind of wonders, which is this. Can you explain why do investigations, and I'll use air quotes, take so long?
Oh, yeah, we hear that question a lot.
I bet.
Sure, and a lot of it goes back to the process we use for the major investigations. One of the most important things we pride ourselves on, at least at the NTSB, is the thoroughness and the completeness of the investigations. It's pretty easy to just get to the pointy end and say, oh, the pilot landed too fast or something like that. Well, that doesn't really help anybody all that much.
Right.
It doesn't lead us to the root cause and doesn't really lead us to anything that can actually prevent future accidents. So it's important to us to get very complete, to get into all the factors, all the contributors to that accident, and that takes some time. Part of that is also the process that we use where we introduce parties. So the airframers, the engine manufacturer, the operator, pilots unions, various other entities with a technical interest take part in our investigations. So making sure that all those parties have all the same information, that's all open, and all those parties have an opportunity to have their say and have their input. We need them as much as they need us. Remember, we're only 400 people and about 150 in aviation. So we've got to pull in all that expertise from outside as well and leverage that so that everybody gets to see and participate in there.
But in that case, the NTSB, though, is the party in charge, correct?
Absolutely. Yeah, NTSB leads the investigation, at least in the U.S., and then the parties take part. They sort of have to wear their NTSB hat or windbreaker and work for us in effect when they participate on an investigative group. We populate different subject matter groups in a major investigation, so we might bring in someone from the engine manufacturer to work with one of our engine specialists. We'll have people from the airline and the airframer, for example, on an operations group of test pilots and training pilots working right alongside our guys.
When there are other OEMs, airframers, engine manufacturers, other component manufacturers involved in the investigation, and tell me if you really can't answer this question, but what do you find is their attitude? I mean, are they kind of tending to be protective of their reputations, or are they, you know, kind of open? What's the sort of the mood of an investigation typically?
Well, that's a good question. Of course, an investigation, an accident, is very stressful for anybody that's involved, even a major corporation that's seen this before. With the usual participants, the major airframe manufacturers and so on that we work with a lot, they typically have a division of staff that works with us on a regular basis. So they know the rules, they know the process, they know the routine. So that helps it go pretty smooth. Very rarely do we get anything that looks like protectiveness or anything like that. Mostly they're more afraid of the courts and the media than they are of the investigation, because we've got a pretty strong process that we've been doing for a long time, and most everybody understands that. Small operators or someone who hasn't experienced it before, they'll tend to be defensive because they're just being overwhelmed with the other things that are going on, the legal aspects and so on. And the accident investigation is just part of what they have to deal with.
Rob, I'm sure you've got some questions.
Actually, I'm kind of curious, how did you come to be interested in a position as an investigator?
Well, I think I've pretty much always been interested in it. I don't know when I ever was not interested in it. And I have to say right now, I am what I want to be when I grow up, which is kind of nice. But I worked my way through various flying jobs and was always interested in the safety part of things and like this project management aspect of it as well. While I worked for the FAA back in the 90s, I did sort of stumble into doing some investigations internally for them. And working on a couple of accidents up in the Northeast, the MD-80 at Bradley, the CW-800 accident I got involved with and got to know some of the people at the board, and eventually worked out to move on down here.
Yeah, I think that's pretty cool. That's the one thing I look back on my life after having worked for FAA for 10 years, that I wish I could have gone into that direction instead, because I think that would have been pretty interesting. Despite the fact that it's for the government, but that's
okay. Well, so is the FAA, right?
Well, that's true. But of course, the FAA doesn't get to wear those cool jackets.
Yeah. No, they have FAA jackets. You didn't get one of those?
No.
They kept them free. Well, I'll be honest with you. This is a fascinating job. There's something new and different all the time. That's a really great part of it.
And how many investigators are there? Because you could do, as you said, you're an aviation guy, but could you do, as you said, pipeline or something else also?
No, we've got specialties there. We don't cross modes very much. So an aviation person tends to stay in aviation and so on. Rarely that does happen. Somebody crosses modes, but usually you stay there. And then within an aviation, we're compartmentalized a bit too. We've got our own areas. I'm in the major investigations division, so we're the investigators in charge of the large GO team. You've heard of the GO team, and that's where we assemble for a major air carrier investigation. So there's, I say 5.5 of us to basically cover the U.S. and the world. And I say half because one of the guys in our shop, half works for us as investigations just in Africa, and the other half of his time he works for a State Department outreach program to develop safety programs for Africa. And then the rest of us are leaders of the GO team for a major investigation. And then there's subject matter specialties in headquarters as well. We've got operations, which is like air carrier pilots, meteorologists, aircraft structures, power plants, human factors, and so on. There's probably a dozen specialties. And each of those specialties have 3 or 4 people working in each of that division. So they'll be the people we pick the members of a GO team for to respond to a major accident. Or those folks might on occasion also support a smaller scale investigation. Those are usually run by our regional investigators that are out about the country. We used to have actual offices. Some of them are virtual now. And those are the folks who mostly cover the non-commercial or general aviation accidents. And there's maybe 30 or 40 of them scattered around the country.
Bill, I know you're not at liberty to talk about any active investigations, but when you look back on those that you have completed, are there any that kind of stand out as being remarkable or memorable, something that you can tell us?
Oh, sure. A lot of the investigations I've had overseas have been some very groundbreaking watershed accidents. In 2006, I participated in the Brazilian mid-air collision between a 737 and the Legacy jet.
Ah, yes.
So I was the U.S. accredited rep for it because obviously we had a Boeing 737, and then the Legacy was U.S. owned and operated, so an N-registered airplane. So we had quite a bit of involvement in that, and that became an incredibly complex investigation. The response was very interesting. We ended up out in the middle of the Amazon jungle, literally down in a 40-meter hole in the jungle, hiking through about as far away from civilization as you can get to recover the recorders and some evidence from the Boeing, all the way down to the cities of Brazil and this air base out in the middle of the jungle where the Legacy landed. I'm sure you've seen pictures of that airplane that survived a mid-air collision at 36,000 feet.
Yeah, remarkable.
You don't see that every day.
No, you don't.
And, of course, that was a watershed accident that brought a lot of attention to the criminalization of accident investigations. That's one of the major challenges we face now worldwide. You see a lot of that spreading and definitely becoming a hot issue in the investigation world.
I think we kind of consider that, because we've talked about that a little bit on the show in the past, and we consider that to be a bad thing. Is that kind of how you view it as well, the criminalization of these activities?
Sure. I don't think there's anybody in the investigative world that that doesn't think so. Criminalization causes the participants to just clam up. They're afraid of penalties and imprisonment and whatnot, and that does not serve us well at all for an open and thorough investigation. If people are just looking for somebody to blame and somebody to throw in jail, that generally doesn't solve the problem.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I wanted to go back a little bit to you. Were Rob asked you, why or how you came to be in this field. And I kind of wanted to see if, to kind of poke at that a little bit and see if you could describe what are the kind of characteristics that make for a good investigator of this sort?
Yeah, that's a good question. At least in this position and as an IIC, I think you really have to be pretty open-minded and just about a little bit interested in everything. There's this internet essay going around that you might have seen that everything is interesting. Yeah, and it really is once you start digging into it. It's amazing what kind of details there are behind just about anything you see. So I think an open mind and a curiosity is definitely traits that you need in any type of investigation, whether you're a generalist like an IIC would be or a regional investigator or a specialist in a certain subject matter. Someone asked me before what the job of the IIC is like, and I think a lot of folks imagine that to be like the general on his horse, leading the troops off into battle. And it's not so much. Imagine more like the whitewater rafting guide. sitting up in the back with his little rudder, frantically hollering directions out to a bunch of people waving big sticks around while trying not to hit rocks and capsize.
Yeah.
That's pretty much the job of the IIC. And it's just as thrilling.
Oh, yeah, I was going to say, it sounds like never a dull moment. Or is there? I mean, you said you had a lot of investigations active, so I guess you're probably not sitting around the office very often waiting for the next accident to occur.
No, usually not. But there is a lot of process stuff that goes on behind the scenes. There's some just sitting at a desk typing things into a computer and having endless meetings, just like any other job. So there is all that. But that's what it takes to get a good product out that the public can use.
And how about the guys that take all the little bits of aluminum and other assorted airplane parts and, you know, haul them off to a warehouse and put the jigsaw puzzle together? How do they do that?
Yeah, that's a great skill. We've actually still got the TW-800 wreckage that we pieced all together. That's out at our academy out near Dulles Airport in Virginia.
Oh, really?
So we still use that as an educational tool. We generally don't put a whole airplane back together. A little bit of that is just TV. We lay out things on a hangar floor. And once you get used to it, you can pretty much see where things are supposed to go. Little bits and pieces of skin generally aren't all that important. You can find the structural pieces and the major components, systems, and all that, somewhat looking like them once you get used to seeing them in a wreckage situation. So we do layouts sometimes on scene. We did some layouts in a little narrow valley in the mountains in Lake Mead last week of a helicopter, and just laying things out in the dirt to see where things went. And sometimes we'll take it back to a boneyard, to a warehouse type of facility to set things up. But those full up, build them up on scaffoldings and all that doesn't happen all that often.
Okay.
I'm curious, Bill, have you noticed in your years with the NTSB, has there been any one particular situation that just kind of left you in awe? I mean, good, bad, ugly, I don't know anything, but just wow. Kind of.
Yeah, I think these things happen a lot. Last year, we had the UPS 747 accident in Dubai. It was cargo aircraft, cargo fire, and they crashed into the desert southwest of Dubai, and the airplane burned for about 24 hours after it crashed, post-crash fire, fuel fire. Mm-hmm. And an enormous wreckage site, mostly just burned out, hardly anything left of the airplane. And after a few days of on scene, we went over to the airport to look at a sister airplane, another 747. And we kind of forgot how big a 747 is, standing there on the ramp looking at it. And we thought about the wreckage site and thought, where did it all go?
Yes. Yeah. It's amazing how much you can burn up.
Yeah.
Well, this has been fascinating. Bill, is there some question that we haven't asked that you get asked a lot, or have we kind of covered most of the ground?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, people get into some of the technical details a lot. I mean, flight recorders fascinate a lot of people, and you know, the black boxes. And there's been lots of changes with the black boxes, the flight recorders over recent years. They're technically much more capable than they were years ago, and they tend to become part of the legal side of things as well. We protect the audio, the CVR, by law, but I think there's some encroachment on that. Some court cases that are chipping away at the protections that we're able to provide to the CVR. Hopefully, we'll be able to maintain those protections. But it's a constant fight.
When do you think they're going to come clean and stop calling them black boxes?
Because
everyone knows
black.
That they're orange.
That's right. Well, they're black after the accident.
Yeah, I guess so. Huh?
Yeah. I who knows? They keep saying the so-called black boxes, but it's only the media that says black boxes. So
yeah,
I don't know.
Everyone says flight recorders or
just recorders, boxes. Cockpit recorders. We'll say just boxes. Yeah.
All right. Well, that's great, Bill. Thank you so much for joining us. I think you've answered all the questions.
I got one.
Do you?
Dan?
Is that Dan?
Well, I had other questions, but then Rob just kept stealing them.
Barging in.
Fire away, Dan.
I was being polite. Rob kind of touched on it already, Bill, but since we have a lot of younger listeners, if someone wanted to be you one day, you know, how does one get into the NTSB? Like, any specific thing? We have, like, a lot of high school kids, so, like, any specific, like, majors in college they should explore? Or
Sure. Yeah, I don't know if they want to be me, but if they want to be in that safety and investigations, I mean, there are college majors that concentrate on that. The major aviation universities do all have aviation safety programs. And I just say, get into the industry and keep your eyes open and be that sponge. Be curious. You never know where that's going to lead you. There's some component of safety and investigation in just about any subject matter that crops up. And so don't worry about being on railroad tracks. Keep your eyes open. Keep your mind open. I think that's probably the best way to go about it.
Okay. Good advice.
Well, come check out the NTSB on our website is ntsb.gov. We've got a news feed. We've got a Twitter feed and a YouTube feed. And you can keep up on everything we're doing.
Fantastic. Thanks so much for being with us.
You're quite welcome.
Hey, Bill, what's in your go bag?
A lot of clothes, a Leatherman, camera, laptop, boots, a lot of boots. We've got a little kit that's got Tyvek suit, bio bags, rubber gloves, rubber boots, other personal protective gear. It's mostly that kind of stuff. Personal protective gear, biohazard protection is a big deal. Other than that, rough weather clothes. I basically have a little bit of everything in there, so I like to say I'm ill-prepared for any eventuality.
And how many times in a year do you, literally grab that bag and go?
For a major investigator like myself, it's not that often, maybe 6 or 8 times a year.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and they're generally longer-term things. The regional guys go all the time, but it's usually going to be a day or so, Cessna ran out of gas in a cornfield kind of thing.
Yeah, interesting. All right. Yeah, good question, David. All right, now here's David Vanderhoof, our official Airplane Geeks historian with This Week in Aviation.
Thanks, Max. Welcome to This Week in Aviation, Volume 3, Episode Number 37, December 18th through December 24th. December 18th, 1941, First Lieutenant Boyd David Buzz Wagner shoots down a Zero over Clark Field in the Philippines. That Zero would be Wagner's fifth. Since the war had begun on December 8th, 1941, in the Philippines, when the Japanese began to invade. He evacuated the Philippines in 1942 to Australia. Buzz Wagner got the title Buzz because he flew so low he could buzz the camouflage off of a hangar.
Wow.
After a December 21st, 1968 launch, Apollo 8's crew commander, Frank Borman, Command Module Pilot James Lovell and Lunar Module Pilot William Anders became the first people to orbit another body on December 24th, the Moon. They orbited 20 times before safely returning to Earth. Apollo 8 had a huge number of firsts. The first crewed spacecraft to leave Earth's orbit. The first crew to be captured by and escape another celestial body's gravity, the Moon. The first people to see Earth in its entirety. The first people to ever see the dark side or far side of the Moon, the first crewed launch of a Saturn V, and the first launch from then brand new Kennedy Space Center. The very famous Christmas Eve television broadcast, where the crew read the first 10 verses of Genesis, was at the time the most watched viewed television show. First flights that occurred during the week of December 18th through the 24th. The Curtis Wright SB-2C Hell Diver, December 18th, 1940. The Tupolev Tu-160, codenamed Blackjack by NATO, December 18th, 1981. The Junkers Ju-88A, December 21st, 1936. The Convair F-102 Delta Dagger, December 20th, 1954. The General Dynamics F-111 Aardvark, December 21st, 1964. 6 years later, the aircraft that replaced the Aardvark in the Navy, the General Grumman aircraft F-14A Tomcat, December 21st, 1970. The Anatov AN-225 Mira, otherwise known as the Cossack in NATO, December 21st, 1988. The Consolidated TBY Seawolf, December 22nd, 1941. The North American F-86 Deed Saberdog, December 22nd, 1949. The Antonov AN-72 NATO callsign Kohler, December 2nd, 22nd, 1977. The Kamov KA-126, December 22nd, 1988. The Dassault Mirage F1, December 23rd, 1966. The Rockwell B1 Lancer, or otherwise known as the Bone, December 23rd, 1974. The Sikorsky S-92, or the CH-148 Cyclone, December 23rd, 1998. The Mach-E C-200 Sierra, December 24th, 1937. The Hanley Page HP-80 Victor, December 24th, 1952. The Kamov KA-27 NATO callsign Helix, December 24th, 1973. And last but not least, the Kamov KA-60 Kazakha, or otherwise known as Orca, December 24th, 1998. And as always, this episode of the year comes my yearly Christmas carol. So this one we'll call a Christmas wish. Frosted aeroplanes, hangars glow with a warmth, red and white green runway lights, so to see. Santa's on his way, he's filled his sleigh for things. For geeks like you and for me, it's that time of year when flying's towards home, every comm chatter you hear seems to say, Merry Christmas, may your airplane geek dreams come true. And this song of mine in three-quarter time wishes you, our fans, the same thing too. And besides our fans, I'd like to thank some people who on the show don't get thanked enough. And without them, we wouldn't be able to do it. So in alphabetical order, I would like to thank Kathy, Kit, Lisa, Nancy, and Michelle. Merry Christmas, all. And this is David M. Vanderhoof. We'll see you next year. And that's the way it was December 18th through the 24th.
Wow. You're full of surprises this time, David.
You know, I don't know which thing I'm more impressed with, the lyrics that David comes up with or the fact that he's the only one among us that would have the guts to sing a Christmas carol.
Can we just, you know, I think among the four of us, and maybe Stephen Grant and Peter can chip in, how much do you think a copy of Auto-Tune will cost?
Oh, no, let's not go down that road. Oh, well, thank you very much, David. You said...
Nice job.
Yeah, very nice job. You said the B1... the Bone?
Yes.
Where did that come from?
Well, spell it out. If you take the word B and then write out O-N-E, you get...
Duh.
Bone.
Okay. Now I get it.
What was the other one? The Saber Dog? Is that one? Is that what you said?
The F-86D, Saber Dog. It was the F-86 version with the radar in the nose.
Oh,
it
that point.
And it had... And it was a longer fuselage, and it had a rocket pack in the center. The F-86D was originally going to be called the F-92, but for political reasons, they decided to rename it the F-86D. So that, and it forever became the Sabre D, or the Sabre Dog.
All right, let's move on to the Australia-Pacific region.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australia News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plain Crazy Down Under podcast.
Oh, the weather outside is frightful, but the fire is so delightful. Since we've no place to go, let it snow, let it snow, let it snow.
Hey, Grant, what's all this talk about snow? Don't they know it's Christmas time?
Oh, mate, maybe up there in the cold and frigid north where the airplane geeks are, but down here in the beautiful, sort of somewhat, a bit more summery part of the world, it's a beautiful 20 to 30 degrees Celsius, and in fact may even go to 40 by the time New Year's Eve rolls around. And what else do we do at Christmas? That's right, Santa Claus throws away the venison, gets out the kangaroo, and it's all systems go.
Throw another snag on the barbie there, would you?
Yeah, for sure, man. Here you go. You want two, or do you want 12?
I want 12. I've been in this diet too long.
Here you go, mate. Here, have another tray.
Thank you. 12 trays. Lovely.
Oh, mate, we'll see more of you in the new year, that's
good,
for sure.
Goodbye, Jenny Craig. Hello, Christmas.
Yes, it's the time to have shrimp on the barbie, according to some, but no, for the rest of us, it's down to the beach, hang out, Santa puts on board shorts, goes and catches a good curl out on the waves, and yeah, we have a really good time, don't we?
Absolutely. Well, except for me, he'll be working right through Christmas, but let's not go there, Grant. Somebody else who won't be celebrating over Christmas is Air New Zealand. They look like their long-haul network is making a bit of a loss.
That's right. It looks like hundreds of jobs at Air New Zealand could be slashed, and the London route is in question because their long-haul service and the network is losing money. They want to lift annual profit by $110 million after posting a six-month loss of $37 million to the end of June, thanks mostly to the earthquakes in Christchurch area and also in Japan.
And Chief Executive of Air New Zealand, Rob Fyfe, has actually put a letter out to all his employees, and in there he quotes, amongst other things, the need to reduce costs to reflect the lower level of demand for air travel that they're likely to see in the coming 12 months with increasing price competition as our competitors struggle to fill their aircraft. And, you know, that could be an indication of the worldwide economy as a whole, Grant, but the other thing I find interesting is the parallels to Qantas, who are also cutting back their services from Australia to London.
Indeed, indeed. And we've been looking at Air New Zealand as being an airline that seems to be getting it right. So finding that even the airline that gets it right is having some problems, it's just not a good look out there. And it is pretty hard to compete with the bigger carriers who are able to spread costs over so much more. And when you're so far away, yeah, you can see where the issues might be coming up. But I like what Fyfe said, there are no sacred cows. In other words, anything that looks like it's not going to be making money is going to be cut. I'm a little concerned here. This could be a death by a thousand cuts and send them on the similar way that Qantas went when the bean counters took over. We'll keep an eye on it and see what happens, yeah?
Yeah, I'll tell you what though, Air New Zealand has proved itself to be pretty resilient over the last 10 years since they were embroiled in the Ansett debacle. So, you know, I'd have to say that they have a pretty positive spirit over there, and let's see what happens in the next 12 months. I noticed, Grant, their share price is down 39% this year.
Yeah, it hasn't been a really good year, and I've been reading in a few places that the economic situation in Europe is going to have a lot of impact on travel in Asia. There's a lot of Europeans are no longer going overseas for holidays. They can't afford it. All this kind of stuff, then a big source of tourists into the Asia-Pacific area are drying up.
Well, speaking of the Asia-Pacific area, and I guess the Pacific more particularly, Grant, Air Pacific, the Flying Fruit Tingle, they're bouncing back from record losses. I wouldn't say they're not making a loss, but perhaps not as big a loss as they have been making.
That's right, mate. The smiles are pretty big over there because previously they'd lost 91.8 million Fijian dollars. Yep. Now they've only lost 3.6 million Fijian dollars. 3.6 million Fijian dollars is about 1.92 million Australian dollars. So that means it's probably about 1.88 million US dollars.
Now, Grant, the customer satisfaction ratings are in for the year with regard to Australian airlines, and it looks like Virgin is certainly catching up to Qantas when it comes to customer satisfaction. Probably given the tumultuous year that Qantas has had, that's probably not much of a surprise.
Yeah, and also the business class and various other improvements that Virgin is introducing. They've generally been pretty good with their cabin crew. They've always looked after us pretty well when we travel there. I mean, so have Qantas. A lot of the Qantas crew have been pretty good, but there's more to it than that. There's all the everything that goes around it in terms of the call centres and the check-in staff and all those other ancillary operations as opposed to ancillary charges. But yeah, the figures are in, and Qantas is leading in October at 84%, which was down from its high earlier in June, but Virgin has come up to 81%. They have recovered since the big meltdown of their booking system, and people are generally giving them an 81%. The industry average is apparently 75% based on these kind of surveys done around the world. And Jetstar came in at 68. So, oops, not quite at the industry average. But, you know, Jetstar should still be pretty happy because, hey, Tiger got 44%.
Yes, there must be something wrong with that rating system. I think over here in the PCDU East recording facility, they'd get 0% grant.
Yeah, well, I think Tiger Airways executives were kind of happy with 44% given the year they've had. they knew how close they could be at zero.
Well, I think that just about wraps up the Australia desk for 2011. Grant, boy, what a big year we've had.
Oh, it's been huge, mate. Absolutely huge. So much, so little time. It's hard to believe it's been a whole year since last Christmas, but been a lot that we've managed to do, mate. I'm pretty happy with the year so far.
We've had a huge year, and of course, this little podcasting adventure, which for us began right here on the Airplane Geeks podcast back in 2009, has now taken us from one side of the planet to the other, literally, with our trip to the United States. We've been in several states around Australia, It's been a huge journey, and as always, I really want to thank Courtney Miller and Max Flight in particular for kicking this adventure off for us, because without those two guys, this would never have happened. In fact, Grant and I probably would never have even started recording together were it not for Courtney and Max, so it's your fault, guys.
Indeed. If you want to get abusive, send it to Courtney and Max, because they're the ones that helped start this. I mean, we may have taken it into a whole different world of pain, but they helped start it.
So we want to take this opportunity to wish all listeners of the Airplane Geeks podcast a very, very Merry Christmas, and our best wishes for a safe and prosperous 2012. It looks like it's going to be a bit of a tough year coming up economically, but I'm sure if we all stick together and as Airplane Geeks, well, we'll get through it.
Yeah, mate, and we'd also definitely like to say Merry Christmas and thanks heaps to all the guys at the Geeks, to Max for making it all happen and being the glue that binds it all together. He is the force when it comes to the Geeks.
Absolutely. And this, as we've said, this is a very, very important segment to us. We really enjoy doing it, and we hope that everybody enjoys the work that we do, and I hope you find it informative as well. It's something we take very, very seriously, and as I say, we really do enjoy doing it. And we want to thank Rob for letting us hijack his office this year in Chicago when we came over, and it was great to meet everybody. Shame we couldn't meet Max, but maybe the next time we come over, we can do that. We'll come and stay at Max's house, Grant.
There you go, and maybe there'll be something close to the Massachusetts, Rhode Island kind of area. Yay! And also, Rob, big high and scratch behind the ears for Simba, the favourite wonder dog.
Ah, Simba, my friend.
And, of course, a big thanks to Dan for all the statistics, the fun, and just being there for us to poke fun at. It's great. Thanks, Dan.
Absolutely. And a big shout-out to Peter Johnson. I guess it'll be snowing over where you are too, Peter. I hope you have a great Christmas, mate. And, of course, to David Vanderhoof, our great friend, and what a highlight it was for me to finally meet you in person this year, mate. And let's hope we do it again next year.
Indeed, mate. It was great to meet up with David, and fingers crossed we can get our sorry selves over to Oshkosh once again.
And we met Aunt Binet as well.
Oh, yeah, can't forget Aunt Binet. In fact, I just heard her on that other show we occasionally get on. I heard Aunt Binet on Flight Time Radio.
Oh, she's awesome. She's everywhere.
There you go, mate, just like we are. Wait a minute. Anyhow, and with that, mate, I'd just like to say to everyone who's not celebrating Christmas, have a great Hanukkah, have a great Yuletide festive season, enjoy the midwinter solstice, whatever rocks your boat and makes you happy. Just have a really great time at the end of the year, and all the best for the new year.
Yeah. All right, Grant, I'm going to kick back here in my banana lounge and have another beer. What about you?
Oh, well, I'm just looking out at the waves and I think, oh, yep, Santa just dumped off the longboard.
Oh, dear. I'll tell you what, all this recording makes me pretty weary. I'm feeling a bit tired. I don't know. We've got a good sign-off tag. Maybe this scruffy-looking bloke walking down the beach could sign off for us.
Yeah, why not? Let's give him a whirl.
I'm pretty tired. Think I'll go home now.
Oh, thanks to Steve and Grant for that.
Question of the day.
Yes.
If you are the glue, what does that make me and Rob?
It's a good question.
The talent.
How diplomatic of you.
No, I'm kind of serious. Really seriously, thanks to Steve and Grant. We really appreciate their contribution to the content here. And really, I invite all the listeners, if you haven't gone over to plaincrazydownunder.com, it's a fantastic show. And while it certainly centers on that region, they always have a lot of interesting activities and interviews and conversations, and it's an enjoyable aviation podcast. So check that out if you haven't yet.
Just don't forget to come back.
Yeah, don't forget to come back.
And plus, I mean, it was great. I assure, as David wrong, it was great to finally meet up with them in person in Oshkosh.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I say that I wasn't there, but. I know you guys have.
Yeah, we noticed.
Yeah, maybe next time. All right, let's shift across the other direction to Europe, and here's Peter Johnson across the pond.
Today, I'm joined by a fellow European aviation podcaster. This time, we're talking to Mark Maiden, who presents the Maiden Flight podcast. And today, Mark joins us from Dublin in Ireland. Mark, welcome to Across the Pond.
Thank you very much, Peter. It's great to be here, and thanks for having me.
Really, really pleased to have another aviation podcast in Europe.
I guess I started looking to do some flight training last year in 2010. And as I was looking around the flight schools here in Dublin in Ireland, and also just looking up for information on the internet, I actually found a lack of information from people who have experienced flight training here in Ireland. Yeah. I didn't find very, you know, there was no blogs or podcasts or anything about students who had gone through particular schools. And I was actually very interested to find out people's experiences were. As I went through and picked my flight school, I just thought, well, wouldn't it be nice to just kind of track my experiences? Maybe somebody else might be interested in hearing what it's like to fly in Ireland, and also just to be able to give back to the aviation community here in Ireland. And I've also just been so entertained and also educated by a lot of the podcasts out there, including the Airplane Geeks podcast. It's a great podcast. So hi to the geeks from Ireland. But it's been great. So I just thought, well, why don't I just give it a go over here in Ireland?
Hello, everyone. This is Etienne, air traffic controller from Switzerland. I wish every one of you a Merry Christmas and safe flying in 2012.
What do you need to become a licensed pilot?
Actually, in a lot of ways, it's very similar to learning in the United States. The actual flying portion of it is very similar. You have to have a minimum of 45 hours. 25 of those need to be with an instructor. 10 of those need to be solo. Then, of course, you have to do your own solo cross countries as well. In the other aspects, it's quite different. When it comes to the theoretical knowledge examinations, there are 6 hours of examinations to do. So they're broken up into 4 different topics. That means you're doing quite a lot of ground study, and you actually have to get signed off by a registered training facility here in Ireland before you go for those exams as well. The Irish Aviation Authority demands that you actually do all 4 of the exams in one go. So on the first time you sit them, you have to do them all in one day now, which is, you know, so this kind of rules out the whole thing of trying to swat up for an exam, really, because you really need to know your stuff when you're going in. And I guess that's probably the idea, that they expect you to know this stuff.
Mark, while we're just talking about the license, is that a JAA European license?
It is, exactly. So you can fly in other European countries with that.
So what flying school are you with, and what aircraft are you training on?
Well, I spent a bit of time looking around some of the schools. The one I settled on is a club. It's called the Leinster Aero Club. And it's been a club that's been around in Ireland now for a good 50 or 60 years. It's got a very good reputation. It's run as a non-profit organization, obviously. So that means that the instructors give of their own time when they're teaching the students.
Goodness me, that's unusual.
It is very unusual. That's right. And amazingly enough, the instructors are such experienced guys. The chief flying instructor used to be the chief pilot in Aer Lingus. My instructor that I've flown with the most, his name is Richard, and he's a pilot of an Airbus A330 for Aer Lingus. So these guys are so passionate about aviation that and about teaching that they give up their own time at the weekends and in the evenings in the summer to come down to the club and to teach guys like me how to fly. So I just think it's a fantastic setup, and there's a great atmosphere there. People will hang out in the club on a Saturday and just talk, and it's a great place to fly. I'm really enjoying it there.
Hello, I'm Diego from the Spanish Podcast Aero Podcast. I wish a Merry Christmas to all Airplane Geek Podcast listeners. And now in Spanish, Feliz Navidad y un Feliz Año Nuevo a todos. Bye-bye.
Excellent. And what aircraft do they use, and are you training on?
It's a little low-wing single-engine airplane called a Robin HR-200. It's incredibly stable. It's a lovely plane to fly now. Really enjoying it.
And has that got a yoke or a stick?
It's got a yoke.
Right.
And the interesting thing as well is it has a throttle on the left-hand side of the captain's side too.
Okay.
So both instructor and student can have a throttle, which is handy.
What are your ambitions?
I'm loving it so much, Peter. I just really, really enjoying it, and I would love to do more with it. I guess I would love to go on and do maybe an instrument rating, considering the weather we have in this part of the world. You can understand that. Yeah, it would be nice to be able to fly more in the winter and even in the summer.
Is this turning out to be an expensive experience?
When you compare prices, for an example, here in Ireland, to rent a Cessna 152, it could be anywhere between 180 and 210 euros. So for our friends across the pond, that could be anywhere up to $280 for a Cessna 152 for an hour. So it does really add up. And I'll be honest, that was one of the reasons, not the major reason, why I went with the club, because they do have cheaper prices because they're not trying to make a profit, obviously, and pay their instructors.
Okay, and before we leave you, Mark, whereabouts are you in your flying training at the moment?
Well, I'm actually very close to going solo. My instructor, I'm kind of getting a bit nervous here. So my instructor has kind of started talking less when in the lessons. So that's, I guess, a good sign. And he's told me to just prepare over the next couple of hours. It might happen. So I'm very excited about that. I'm kind of nervous too. But who knows? Maybe sometime I'll come back on across the pond and let you know what happened.
We really, really would like to track your progress. Well, we wish you all the very best with your training. And for those of you who are not familiar with the Maiden Flight podcast, where can we find you on the internet?
Yeah, you can get the podcast through iTunes if you just search for Maiden Flight Podcast. The actual website is maidenflightpodcast.blogspot.com, and you can reach me by email at maidenflightpodcast@gmail.com.
Well, Mark, I've certainly enjoyed the first few episodes of the podcast. I think if you're learning to fly anywhere in the world, it's well worth a listen. So please go and join Mark in his experience getting through his license. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Peter. And just another hi to the geeks, and just to let them know to prepare for a few Irish Grill the Geeks questions. They come their way.
Excellent stuff. Thanks a lot, Mark.
Thanks, Peter.
Greetings from Phoenix, Arizona. This is Pilot NGB recording a special Christmas message to all the listeners of the Airplane Geek podcast. I wish you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. All the best for 2012.
You can find Peter Johnson at Nascot Hornet and at alphatangopapa.blogspot.com.
Oh, thank you, Peter. I don't know if you guys have listened to the Maiden Flight podcast, if you've had a chance to catch that. It's pretty new. He's got just a few episodes out. But I tell you, it is really good. It is very well produced. Very nice podcast.
I'm going to have to go try that. I mean, I was just amazed at some of the things that he had to say. My gosh, the price of flying over there. And
so much more.
Wondered how far away he could go on his cross countries, though. I mean, it's not that big an island.
That's true. I guess that's true. All right, you know what that means. It's time for Grill the Geeks and Grill the Listeners. In fact, let's start off with a bit of Grill the Listeners. We had some questions that we posed. Dan, I'm going to ask if you'd start with yours. Maybe you can repeat the question you asked again, and we can go through some of these responses. We got a lot of responses from a lot of listeners.
So my question was, what U.S. airline was slated to become the only carrier to order and operate the Airbus A340? And we got a lot of responses, and unfortunately I wasn't here last week. So we had a lot of close ones, but no one got the complete answer, because I also asked who was the other North American operator of the A340. And also, under what circumstances would the unnamed U.S. airline become, under what circumstances would they get the aircraft and how they would use it? So, no one was totally off, but do you want me to read through the responses?
Maybe you can highlight a few of them or mention names of the folks that, that answered.
Well, Dave guessed Eastern, but that was wrong. Elliot said it was easy, and it was going to be U.S. Airways, which is true, but he said it would be the A350-500, which is
A340-500.
A340-500, which is wrong. But he was right that Air Canada was the other one, the other major listener. Mike was right also with U.S. Airways. Elliot also said they would be flown to China, which is true, but he said it would be to Shanghai and Beijing, which is wrong. Micah said U.S. Airways, which was right. So the closest was Sven, And he said U.S. Airways is the only U.S. airline which had an option to become an A340 operator. They signed options for the A330-200, which would then have been able to transform to an order of two A340-300s, which was close, but not right. But he was right that it would be used for Philadelphia-Beijing. So basically, the full answer is, a few years ago, some China frequencies became available. International routes can get complex sometimes. On one end of the spectrum, we have something like what the U.S. has with the EU, where basically open skies, anyone can fly anywhere, to generalize a lot. Whereas with China, certain frequencies become available at certain times, and the government allocates them, and the different carriers have to apply and explain why they think their route will be the best, and the DOT basically takes those applications and takes comments and eventually makes a decision. Anyway, U.S. Airways applied to fly from Philadelphia to Beijing a few years ago, and they were going to use the Airbus A340, which at their time they did not have in their fleet. But what they said was, U.S. Airways will have A340-300 aircraft available for service to Beijing on March 25, 2009. As part of its recently announced aircraft order, U.S. Airways obtained an option for A340-300 aircraft deliverable in May or July 2009. So that was part of the answer. But also, initially, however, these aircraft will be brought into the U.S. Airways fleet via lease. So some people were right, but it wasn't the A340-500. It was going to be the A340-300, but Sven was very, very close, but then said it would be converting those options, which was not the case. But people were close, but no one got the full answer.
Oh, that's pretty good. We did get a pretty good response on that.
Yeah.
So you're pretty sure of your facts, though, aren't you?
I'm quoting directly from the U.S. Airways application.
Okay. All right. So, David, how about your
sorry. And eventually, U.S. Airways did get those China frequencies, but Then they kept saying, oh, well, we got to push it back. And eventually they returned the frequencies to the DOT, citing the whole high fuel prices, weak economy,
okay,
all that.
David, you had a question for our listeners as well. We started to talk about it last time, I think, but we got a few more responses in. Did anybody get it right?
Actually, we have a winner. And ironically, the winner actually is Randy DePasquale in Williamstown, New Jersey. Randy sent the answer to me as, hi guys, I believe the answer to David's question is the Bud RB1 Conestoga. If I remember correctly, they got into the airplane business because they had particularly good experience working with stainless steel, meant to be a replacement for aluminum if the nation's aluminum supply was depleted or disturbed during the war. The only reason why I have any idea about this company is because their BB1 Pioneer rests in front of the Franklin Institute in Center City, Philadelphia, just across the river from where I live in New Jersey. David's hint of because I'm from Philadelphia led to me believe what was the right direction. Keep up the great works, right? Randy is right. And we had another from Nick, who also got it right. The answer to David's question about an airplane built by a railroad company is the RB Bud Conestoga. Only 20 were built, but there was a narrow twin-engine transport constructed primarily of stainless steel. And then he went on to ask the question about what was the other airplane that the Bud Company built. And ironically, it was the BB-1 Pioneer. It was the only really, besides the 707 at the Franklin Institute in Philadelphia, it was the only really cool thing to look at there. And the stainless steel airplane is still out in front. It's built by it was a contract by a licensed aircraft of a Simonet Italian seaplane, and it sits out there without any fabric covering, so you get to see the ribs and the skins of the wings. So
that's interesting.
Nick, and I guess I'll be sending out four buttons, both to Nick and Randy, for getting the right answers. And the RB Conestoga is probably one of the ugliest airplanes ever built. If you Google it, it looks sort of like a giant sperm cell with two engines and a wing, because you loaded it from the front of the aircraft. Uh-huh. But it has a charm all its own. And Bud Company was one of those companies that was trying to keep their infrastructure during World War II. So they offered to build airplanes for the Navy. Inevitably, they built 20, which got them off the hook. And by the end of the war, they were able to go back into building railroad cars, which was their primary business.
All right. Very good. Very good. And let's see, Rob, you had a question, too, about the slang term used for Continental Airlines. Was that the question that you had?
Yeah, but did anybody come up with any answers?
We got only one response. Let's see. Let me check. Yes, one response.
Should I repeat the question?
Yeah, why don't you repeat the question?
Okay, so the question I asked was that in the old days, Continental Airlines had a marketing scheme called the Proud Bird with the Golden Tail, and that was because all the tails on the Continental Airlines airplanes were painted gold. And but that within the industry, there was a slang to the marketing phrase that people coined, and I just wondered if anybody knew what it was.
And we did hear from Alex in China, and Alex wrote, "Is NunPass the slang term used for Continental Airlines? It refers to the difficulty in redeeming award points." That's not
sorry,
what you had in
Alex.
Mind, right?
No, that's not the one.
All right, so we're gonna.
I'm sorry. But what do you think? Should we give them one more week, or do you think we've completely?
No, let's let one roll.
Obviously, this one wasn't near as popular as Dan's or David's, but
yeah, you and I didn't get the response that they did. We're not as popular as those two guys, I guess. But
and
well,
the second,
I had another grill the listeners question that I need to address.
But hold on, Rob.
Wait a minute.
It's the second week. You need to give a. Can you give another hint? Last week, the hint I gave was it was built in Philadelphia.
Okay, so I should give them a hint. All right. It has to do with a particular the slang phrase has something to do with a particular kind of metal. And if you understand the particular kind of metal that's involved in the slang on that phrase, you may get the answer.
Okay.
So it's a particular kind of metal. It's not steel, it's not copper, and but
don't
that's
make it
all
too easy now. Okay, and then I had a question as well, and only heard back from Alex, same Alex, who says it's very cold in China. My question was, what aircraft has an engine part that's referred to as the elephant's ass? And only Alex answered, and he's kind of getting at it, but he didn't quite get it. Alex said an elephant ear is an air intake characterized by twin inlets, one on each side of the fuselage. So the elephant's ass is probably the part where the two inlets join. In other words, the rear of the elephant's ears. That's kind of getting warm, but not quite it. And then Alex came back with a second guess, which was the vampire jet. And that's not it either. So we'll let that one ride too. If you know what aircraft has an engine part or component, let's say, that's referred to as the elephant's ass, send that in.
And this, just to be clear, this has nothing, this is not an ex-wife joke. So
no, it's not an ex-wife joke.
Okay, all right. Okay. I just wanted to make sure about it.
Okay, so we're clear. All right, now on to Grill the Geeks. We can do a couple of these.
I thought that's what we were doing.
That was Grill the Listeners.
We were doing Grill the Listeners.
I didn't even finish one of my Grill the Listeners one. We have one more.
You have another one?
We'll take a question, quick one.
Is this a new question you're asking?
No. It's an answer to one I asked that didn't answer.
Did anybody answer it?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Oh, sorry. Okay.
I had a question. Ben answered it. I think someone else answered it, but I don't see it right now. I asked Independence Air. Well, I asked for what regional airline, what certificate went to a different airline to become a Delta Connection carrier. Atlantic Coast Airlines became Independence Air, and they became their own independent carrier, and they failed. That certificate went over to Compass Airlines, which is a new wholly owned subsidiary of Northwest, and then they merged with Delta, and then Delta spun them off. And then also Ben corrected a Grill the Geeks question from a while back, which was, what was the airport with the highest elevation with commercial service east of the Mississippi, I believe? And the correct answer we were told was Pittsburgh, and we believed it. But according to Ben, the highest airport is Asheville, not Pittsburgh. And I checked, Pittsburgh has an elevation of 1,203 feet, whereas Asheville has an elevation of 2,165 feet. So there's that.
And who is the person that stumped us with that Pittsburgh question?
I don't know.
Did we send him buttons?
Maybe.
we may need to recall this. This could be the the first case of an Airplane Geeks button recall.
Right.
Yeah.
It could be like that episode of Law and Order. Turn in your badge.
Okay. Are we ready? So we'll
we're ready for Gorilla Geeks now.
Okay. Let me do this. Let's see. We can do a couple of these. Let's do John Arvin's first. And if Bill, if you're still there, yeah, you can play along too. John wrote.
Okay.
Let's see. He says, "I admit this might be a softball, but what is the only civilian jet ever to use a forward swept wing? The only civilian jet to use a forward swept wing."
I think I know that, but
maybe
Bill knows it.
I think so too, but I'll wait.
No, go ahead. What do you think the answer is?
Do I get a Jetwine button or an Airplane Geeks button?
Yes.
Okay. I think it was. I don't remember the manufacturer. I think it was called the Hansa Jet.
That's it.
Yeah, that's what I would have guessed. Aren't they the ones that made the cars? You know, the Hansa Civic and the.
Oh, God.
I thought those were German.
John says the HFB-320 Hansa Jet is an all-metal, twin-engine, 10-seat business jet built in Germany between 1964 and 1973. He says the most notable feature of the aircraft is its forward-swept wing, which is mid-mounted in the fuselage. This arrangement allows the wing spar to pass through the fuselage behind the passenger cabin without decreasing cabin volume. As of 2011, it remains the only civilian jet ever to use a forward-swept wing.
All right, one for one. What's next?
Maybe we could send the people that don't stump us a button with a big red circle and a line through it.
Not an airplane.
No, because we're all spending a lot of money in postage already.
That's true. Next one, this is from Martin. Let's see. This is a question, well, primarily for Dan, but anybody can play along. Here's the question. Outside of America, which airline operated both the TriStar and DC-10 on scheduled services?
Outside of America?
Outside of America. It operated both the TriStar and the DC-10 on scheduled services.
Oh, God. People will realize that my geekiness does not pass the borders of the United States.
Yeah, you're pretty U.S.-centric, aren't you?
I have a guess.
Well, say it like you know the answer. That way it's more impressive if you're right.
I know the
answer. Rob, what's the answer to this question?
I'm struggling. It's either Lufthansa or it's KLM.
What was the second one?
KLM.
Oh.
Which is now part of Air France.
Is that your final answer?
I know. I can't have two answers.
I'll go with KLM. That sounds...
All right. You want to go with KLM and I'll choose the Lufthansa?
Right. Yeah, good.
All right. You're both wrong.
Wait. Yeah, no.
I knew that, actually.
Yeah. What was it?
British
Airways.
I just
wanted to see if I could sucker Dan in.
Okay.
British Airways.
Who is it?
British Airways. The DC-10s were inherited when they bought British Caledonian.
All right. So we've got to get this on our chart so we can make sure. Who is this person?
This is Martin. Martin is in the UK.
Okay, Martin. So we'll send you some buttons. Do we have Martin's address?
Yes, we do.
Okay.
I'll
ship that to me and I'll ship them off.
Doesn't it seem that most of the buttons that we send out are going overseas?
Yes.
Interesting,
yep.
Huh?
Yeah, maybe Bill, can you investigate that for us?
Yeah, I'll get right on that.
Okay. Thanks.
That's good.
All right.
Mine are going across the river.
That's right. You've got the cheap postage. All right.
We have to make sure we have Bill's address so we can send him some geek buttons, too.
All right. Let's do one more. This is also from Sven, the same Sven in Germany. And let's see, here is my question, he says. It is hard, but David probably knows it.
No pressure.
Yeah, I know. When was the first cargo flight in Germany?
Like by date? Like exact date?
Yeah, well, that's what he's asking.
I mean...
It's sort of a trick question, because I'm sure it was done by a dirigible and not by an airplane. I'll say... 1919.
Wow, that's pretty close.
1920.
No,
it's probably earlier. 1918. It's 1918.
Earlier.
I'm at 18.
August 19th, 1911. The first cargo flight in Germany took place on the 19th of August, 1911. The pilot, Siegfried Hoffmann, started with his navigator Hans Stefan in Berlin, Johannisthal, and they landed 39 minutes later in Frankfurt. The cargo were examples of the Berlin Morgenpost newspaper. So there you have it, the first cargo flight in Germany.
Do we have Sven's address?
And yes, we do have Sven's address.
So what's wrong with these Americans? I don't understand why these Americans are letting all these European folks just whoop them.
So are you going to introduce some competition to this, huh?
Actually, and by the way, I'm going to go back on my, though Sven was still the closest on my question, so he gets buttons anyway. But apparently I did some research. U.S. Airways did say at some point they were going to fly to Shanghai, but I don't think they ever replied, but they said they would apply.
Okay.
Then also, apparently, someone mentioned this. I found a Bloomberg article. Apparently, U.S. Airways wanted to work out something with Air Canada for Airbus aircraft. That never happened either, but yeah. So I was wrong.
All right.
U.S. Airways, Philly, Beijing.
All right. Let's move on to listener mail. First one is a voicemail. We got one voicemail.
Yay.
And here it is.
Hello, fellow aviation geeks from Eastern Colorado, where we're enjoying near standard density altitude and some winter flying. After reading The Night Before Christmas with the kiddos, I was hoping for an aviation rendition. Looking forward to further podcasts. Happy flying.
Wow. So if you do Google around, I found it on AvWeb, but I think you'd find it on other places as well. There is an aviation version of The Night Before Christmas that's very entertaining.
We'll put that link in the show notes.
I like how it ends. It's like, Merry Christmas to all. I have traffic in sight.
Very good. Okay, let's see. An email from Jason. And in fact, he was noting the Hypermach Sonic Star that we talked about. He said, I wanted to throw a quick note about last week's news story. When I heard the story, I immediately thought about some reading I had done on plasma stealth technology. Wow. Although the company's description of their engine technology seems quite convoluted, and maybe for good reason, it seems to point in the direction of some type of airframe electromagnetic charging via massive engine generators. Wow. Similar to the plasma stealth theory, except they would be electrically charging the fuselage for the purpose of boundary layer modification. The Hypermach Sonic Star wiki page states it by saying, quote, any sonic boom is planned to be avoided through the electromagnetic drag reduction technology. And then Jason goes on to provide some more. But, you know, wow. These guys they're just like so far ahead of what anybody else is doing, I guess, in terms of this technology. And wish them luck. We also got an email from David, who says that despite my enthusiasm and lifelong fascination with all things aerospace, I no longer enjoy going to air shows. I think it's a combination of less diversity of aircraft on static display, fewer high-performance and military flybys, and since 9/11, a rather heavy-handed police presence, including metal detectors, vehicle inspections of all bags, and so on and so forth. He says, I understand the need for security, but for me it's just too much intrusive authoritarianism. Yeah, and he goes on with some other comments. But, yeah, I think air shows, and David, maybe you've got a comment on this, that they're not quite the same as they used to be. Are you sensing that as well?
Yeah, well, things change over time, and air shows were a lot bigger deal in the 70s and 80s. It's just much harder, like the Air Force reducing their demonstration teams this year. It's just going to be, that's the way it's going to be. And bases that used to have air shows every year are now going to have them every third year or every second year. Doing an air show is a very expensive prospect. Most people don't realize that the air show has to pay for the Blue Angels gas. They have to pay for their rental cards. They have to pay for their hotel rooms. You realize that every other flight, and pretty much that's the same contract with everybody who shows up. And it's hard when you've only got 10 airplanes and 8 of them are deployed overseas. There's not enough for spares and stuff. So gone are the days where you're going to have flight lines full of aircraft.
Yep.
But luckily, that's one of the reasons why I've changed sort of my attitude. Yes, I used to go to the air shows and I would take hundreds of pictures of the airplanes. Now I go talk to hundreds of people at the air shows, and I've discovered that as I've gotten older, the air shows are more about the people than the airplanes, and I kind of like that.
Hmm. All right, let's see. David, the David who wrote in, actually had a lot of other good comments, which I've shared with the other guys, but he also says regarding the DC-3 and ways to build time as a pilot, he says, I don't think anybody mentioned skydiving. He says, I have around 60 jumps from various C-47s, left side cargo door, and three from a DC-3, or right-hand passenger door. The C-47 is a fantastic jump plane, and as a geek myself, the roar of those radials was worth the slight hearing loss. Also, flying skydivers in a Cessna 182 or whatever at the local drop zone operates is a good way to build hours. I've known quite a few jump pilots who got their hours and multi-engine ratings from flying us nuts up to anywhere from 8,000 to 12,500 to make skydives. A lot of those pilots were able to go commercial. So I think that's interesting. Rob, does that sound like a good way to build hours?
Flying skydiving airplanes, not necessarily skydiving itself.
Right.
You don't get to log the hours that you foolishly jump out of an airplane.
Have you ever jumped out of an airplane, Rob?
Never.
No, neither.
How about you, Bill? Have you ever done that?
Yeah, I jumped out of an airplane once, and it caused the only big fight with my wife that I've ever had.
Was that because you pushed her out first? No,
it was the first and last time. So
she didn't appreciate that, huh?
Yeah, she wasn't real happy with it. It was a great experience, but just a one-time thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I've never done that either. Okay, Bradley wrote in, just finished listening to episode 176, and as usual, it was great. He says, I was wondering if it may be possible to get someone from Pratt & Whitney on the show sometime to tell the story of the GTF. I think a lot of us who have some knowledge of engine technology would really appreciate hearing all about it in depth, and those who may not follow this aspect of aviation as closely, I am sure would also love to hear more. I think a lot of hopes are riding on the GTF and the Leap X. That's true. And I suspect both manufacturers are pulling out all the stops to deliver in the narrow body segment of the market. So good suggestion, Bradley. And in fact, I've been in touch with the Pratt & Whitney Communications Group, and we're trying to line up someone good, hopefully for January, who can talk to us about the GTF. Bradley also says he has a question for any of you guys. He says, with the A340 production line closing, how does the cost of acquiring used 340s compare to that of used 767 and 777 models? I was wondering how likely airlines awaiting 787s looking for some temporary long-haul lift are to consider this model. I realize that the economics of this model are not the greatest fuel burn-wise, but I wonder if this may be offset by a presumed lower cost of acquisition or lease of a now-discontinued model.
I'm thinking for... I don't have a chart of like seat counts in front of me, but I would say that A340 for people waiting for 787 might be a little too much airplane for what they need.
Yeah,
I feel like if you want to, and if you want to go for an Airbus that's 787 ish size wise, it's the 330, and then you have the benefit of not having four fuel burning engines.
Mm-hmm.
So, A340 hasn't really been all that popular overall.
Brad also asks, and I don't know if you know this, where did Air Canada's A340s and 747-400 combis end up?
No,
I don't know.
I think some of the A340s are down in Brazil now, but I'm not sure about the combis.
Okay. Frank sent in a link, and we'll put this in the show notes. This is a YouTube video on Qantas called the Unliking of an Iconic Australian Brand. This is not a video from Qantas, but rather captures some aspects of Qantas' recent behavior with respect to social media and so forth, and how they've maybe damaged their brand. Did you guys get a chance to look at this?
Oh yeah, I did. I thought it was pretty interesting, actually, especially when he compares the number of comments that were made to Qantas versus the ones that they actually answered.
Ah, yeah, I think it really points out how companies need to be aware these days of what's going on in social media concerning, you know, their brand, because sometimes things can leave their control, and you need to watch for that. All right, I know we're running long. I wanted to mention Chris sent in an email. He says, "Hi guys, I guess the question this question is more aimed at Rob, as it's about flight training, but I thought I'd throw it out to all of you." He says, "I'm just finishing my PPL in the UK, and after doing my night rating next, I'm considering coming over to the US to do some hour building. Here's where my problem lies. Although I've been recommended a school in Naples, Florida, by my FI, I'd like to look at a variety of different schools to see what they offer." He says, "I've heard many horror stories of people arranging to come over to the U.S. only to be told that that on arrival there is a month's wait before they can have a check ride, or that the aircraft they paid a deposit for is no longer available. What I'd hoped you guys could help with is how can I make sure a school has a reputable history so there won't be any unfortunate surprises? Have any of you got any recommendations for schools, and is there a time of year I should avoid?" So I asked Rob, and I also asked Max Trescott. Let me give Max Trescott's response, and then we can kind of go to Rob on this as well. But Max Trescott says, "It's a tough problem. If he is just time building, at least he doesn't have to worry about an examiner being available. Florida and Arizona schools are busiest in the winter. Those schools would be thrilled to have his business in the summer when they have little business, although he would be flying in tropical temperatures." And he says, "I definitely go with a larger school with a fleet of at least 10 planes. Smaller schools are less likely to have a plane that they're willing to let go on the road, especially if they feel they could make more money by keeping it close to home, flying their regular local clients. And the rental rates in Florida tend to be a little less expensive than some other parts of the country, so I'd recommend Florida if he's cost-sensitive. On the other hand, Florida is probably the place Christopher Columbus had in mind when he was thinking the world was flat. So if he'd prefer a more interesting mix of terrain and cooler temperatures, I'd suggest he come fly with me at one of the flying clubs at the Palo Alto Airport near San Francisco." And that's from Max Trescott. His site, by the way, is maxtrescott.com. Rob, you might have some comments on this as well, too. I think a lot of folks from outside the U.S. look to come here to build hours, to build time, because the cost is so much lower.
Absolutely. And one thing, we were talking to Chris on email as well, and I kind of shadowed some of Max's comments, Max Trescott, I mean. And one thing I suggested for Chris, though, is that rather than find a school that will only allow you to simply bore holes in the sky around the local airport, especially if you did take Max up that offer to go out to Frisco, you know, see if you can't... for some enjoyable cross-country flying where you have to build time anyway, you could go down to San Diego from Frisco and back two different ways and get some really, really interesting flying, not just geography-wise, but certainly a great mix of air traffic densities passing through the Los Angeles area and through some of the other ones, and just make a really... great fun trip out of some of that. So, but then again, I don't know how much time Chris is going to be here.
Yeah. All right. Then finally, from John. John says, "Hi guys. I know you all have been mentioning flying airliners in a V formation like a flock of birds periodically. And I just saw on my DVR that the latest Mythbusters, which is a television show, is testing that myth with a bunch of general aviation planes. Thought you might like to check it out. Great show. Keep up the good work." Did any of you guys catch this program on Mythbusters? I did not.
No, I didn't see it.
I love that show. And, I mean, if you're not familiar with it, what they do is they'll take a popular myth, and through the application of somewhat slightly scientific methods, sometimes less so, they try to recreate the situation and see if it's true or not. So if any of our listeners have seen this program and know what the result is, let us know. Be curious.
It makes me want to wear a beret, though.
Yeah.
You pain me, Robert, Mark.
I know.
On a side note,
wait till you hear my last idea before the end of the show, Dan. It's gonna just make you nuts.
Great. I have something real quick.
Okay.
Because I got an answer to the question on the Air Canada stuff.
Ah, okay. You've been busy.
This is according to the always very handy aviation website, ch-aviation.ch.
Oh, I love that guy. That's a great site.
Yes. If that's ever been the pick of a week, back when we did a pick of the week, it should have been. Anyway.
You're right.
Apparently, the A340-500s went to TAM in Brazil, though it looks like they're stored right now. And the 300s kind of went everywhere. There's some that, there's one, according to this, there were a couple of former Air Canada birds at Aerolíneas Argentinas, a couple at AirAsia X, Iberia, one at LAN, a few at Swiss, and a couple at Turkish. So all over the place.
Okay.
As for the 747s, I haven't been able to track that down yet.
All right. Well, I think that's going to do it for this episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast.
Wait, for this year.
For this year. Well, I'm going to get to that. It sounds like Rob's got something.
What? I have this great idea.
Okay.
And I want to see what you guys think of it and maybe what our listeners think of it. What if we had an Airplane Geeks swimsuit calendar? And just so everybody, I mean, it could be some pictures of Max and me and David and Dan and Steve and
Oh, that Grant, would be a bust.
Peter and you know, just and we'd all kind of be like
Rob, yeah, Rob, no. I think I can speak on behalf of everybody here.
Yeah. Go ahead, David.
This is the dumbest idea you have ever come up with.
What's actually kind of sad is this idea popped into my head about an hour and a half ago, but I just chose not to say anything.
Oh, I wish Rob hadn't said anything.
Should we go out with a Christmas carol?
Before we do that,
okay, I just.
We'd like to thank our guest for this episode, Bill English from the NTSB. You can learn more about that organization at ntsb.gov. And we'd also like to thank our contributors, Grant McHaren and Steve Vischer from PlaneCrazyDownUnder.com, and also Peter Johnson from alphatangopapa.blogspot.com. All right, well, let's tell folks where they can find us online. We'll start with Dan.
You can find me on Twitter at Dan Webbage, or you can find my blog, Things in the Sky, which is hosted by BoardingArea.com. But ThingsInTheSky.com.
And David Vanderhoof.
You can find me on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof. You can find me on Google Plus as David Vanderhoof. And you can find my blog at WhatJustFlewBy.com.
And Mr. Rob Mark, where do people find you?
Well, let's see. Other than in the gutter with Dan on occasions, Jetwine on Twitter, jetwine.com, the blog, on Jetwine at Facebook, at something or other on Google Plus. I don't even know who I am on Google Plus. So if anybody finds me there, please tell me who I am, because lots of people have been adding me to their circles.
All right. I'll look for you there. I'm Max Flight. You can definitely find me on Google Plus and also on Twitter is Max Flight. And also you can check out the 30,000feet.com aviation directory. You can find show notes for this episode. This is episode 178. Find those at airplanegeeks.com, along with links to the sites we mentioned. Also some photos. Bill English sent a few photos along of some of the accidents that he's investigated, and we'll look to put a couple of those in the show notes too, so you might like to check those out. And be sure to follow Airplane Geeks on Twitter and Facebook. And we're also on Stitcher.com, where you can stream this podcast to your mobile phone. We have an email address, thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And we also have a listener line where you can leave us an audio message. As always, Aunt Benet will tell us that number.
And if you want to call the Airplane Geeks, you can dial 361-GEEKS01.
Now, we should mention that we're taking next week off. So look for the next episode in 2 weeks. That'll be in the beginning of January. Opening and closing music by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. And I'd like to thank those of you who left reviews on iTunes. Your comments there are really deeply appreciated. If you haven't left us a review, please consider doing that. So, join us again next year as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
See you later.
Merry Christmas, everyone, and thank you for listening. Hot as hell. You know.
From the video, it kind of looks like it's maybe a 747 SP sized airplane. I don't know, Dan, did you kind of get to that conclusion?
I'm sorry, I was on mute. What do you want?
Not only were you on mute, you weren't even paying attention.
Bill, just ignore this kind of thing.
Now, David, when you said crewed, you meant C-R-E-W-E-D, right?
Yes.
Okay, just wanted to be clear.
Oh, haha.
Sorry.
I'm sure there's also a bit of an element that they're trying to get you to fail one or two so you can pay again and do it again. But anyway, I won't say more about that.
Of course not. Yeah, of course not.
So even for an English speaker like me, who's been speaking for 38 years, I still had to go through and do a test to show that I could speak English. So I hope you can understand me, Peter. And myself and my instructor are sitting there facing the sky with the engine off and the plane shaking a bit. And he goes, okay, that's it. We've stalled. And I was kind of going, well, is that it? You know, I was expecting some sort of dramatic, you know, nose down, flip over or whatever. And it just kind of was so stable.
By the way, you know, one thing I was going to ask with all those nice notes that Peter had from other people about the podcasts, were you able to field all the gifts that probably came in this Christmas for the rest of the Airplane Geeks?
I've got a whole room full of stacked up with boxes from stuff that listeners sent in. I'll go through it, pick out the stuff I like, and maybe send a few things to you guys.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's why you're the glue, right?
Yeah, that's it.
All the good stuff sticks to you. Okay.
There we go. Yeah, we'll put that show note. Yeah, that show note. We'll put that show note in the links. We'll put that link in the show notes. Bill, thanks so much for joining us.
Bill can't unmute.
I think Bill's taken off.
No, he said a message in the Skype window.
What's it say?
He's like, he said I can't unmute.
Okay. Then let me do a different version of that.
Wish you a Merry Christmas. I wish you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.